Today is June 12, 2017, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington. Coming up on the program, Aung San Suu Kyi explains why a UN fact-finding mission looking into alleged abuses of the Muslim minority Rohingya would not work.
It would have created greater hostility between the different communities.
Orlando marks the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting.
Something like this should never happen. And
They're right, love conquers all.
Also ahead, the U.S. Caribbean territory of Puerto Rico wants to become the country's 51st state and heading into rural America where Hispanics come and go. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Orlando city officials want the one-year anniversary of the shooting at the Pulse nightclub to be marked with acts of love and kindness. June 12th has officially been named Orlando United Day, commemorating the horrific attack on the city's gay and lesbian community, where 49 people died. As Jeff Swikard reports, the city came out in a show of unity during weekend events to mark the tragedy.
They ran in remembrance. 1 year after the largest single attack on the gay and lesbian community in U.S. history killed 49, hundreds gathered in an Orlando park to run and remember the victims. Barbara Palma was the owner of Pulse nightclub where the shooting occurred.
What's different over the last year is everything. Everything is different. Everything you do every day is different. Your heart is forever changed. Your life is forever changed. Your whole direction of life is changed.
At 2 a.m., 29-year-old Omar Mateen entered Pulse nightclub with an assault rifle and began shooting, killing 49 people and wounding 53. Mateen, who had a history of mental instability, had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. The horrific violence of that night deeply scarred all segments of Orlando society. 15-year-old Madeline Ward lived across the street from Pulse and has nightmares about what she saw and heard that night.
And it's really just opened my eyes, showing me that we need to love everyone because it's not, this is like, we're a bunch of different groups of people and we might all be different, but we're all the same in that we're human beings and we need to respect each other no matter who we love.
A year on, Orlando is a community that has come together. At a memorial featuring the Orlando Gay Chorus, a diverse group honored those lost. Dan Jones says the chorus is here to share a message of love and unity with all.
What the shooter was trying to do was destroy the LGBT community, and what he did was brought the LGBT community together, but also built bridges with other communities that we didn't have those bridges with before.
Those bridges have been on display at events during the past week. Last Saturday, Go Big Tees offered free T-shirts, food, and hugs in support of the LGBT community. Hundreds turned out for the food and to tie-dye their own T-shirts. Owner Hannah Zuck says the idea was to gather in love and support for all affected by the tragedy.
I think our community has grown together more, and it's been so beautiful to see the way everyone has unified and supported each other in the healing process.
Pulse nightclub has never reopened after the tragedy. Today it is a memorial to those who died. A place where people can stop by, leave a memento, and reflect.
It's a ring that was in a bag my sister bought for my birthday.
People like Mary Kelly and Taylor Caldwell.
We came here today because, at least for me, I'm really big in the LGBTQ community. And even if I wasn't, I think it would still come just because something like this should never happen. And
they're right. Love conquers all.
It does. And I think the more people that we can draw here just shows that.
Yeah.
Jeff Swikard, VOA News, Orlando, Florida.
And today seems to be a day of anniversaries, good and bad. And with that, we bring in Andrew Bocheski, who has a lot going on social media. What do we have?
Yeah, well, starting with that Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, of course, a lot of people marking the day a year ago where 49 people were killed in that shooting. And so we're seeing hashtag Orlando United Day trending across social media as people mark the day, remember the victims, seeing lots of remembrances on social media for the victims, and lots of instances where people are trying to build from this and move on. People still reeling a year later, a lot of stories of survivors, of the family members who are left behind. So we're seeing just across social media, full coverage, using this hashtag Orlando United Day, the phrase Pulse for the Pulse nightclub, as people talk about this, not just in the U.S., but around the world, because it was something that really did shock the world.
Yeah, it did, and it's going to take a long time to get over that one.
Yes.
Never will, actually.
More than just 1 year, for sure, and that's the sentiment we're seeing, absolutely. Today is also the anniversary, 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia. It was the Supreme Court case that struck down laws banning interracial marriage. So June 12, 1967, 50 years ago today, that ruling with Mildred and Richard Loving. It was actually an Oscar-nominated movie this past year called Loving that chronicled their journey in the Supreme Court case. So people putting up clips from that movie, but celebrating the day, particularly interracial couples saying that they are able to be married and have a family because of this ruling. And that's where a lot of the sentiment lies, too. People are amazed that it was only 50 years ago that a law like this was in place and that was struck down. So people saying that we've come a long way in that time, but amazed that it was in such recent history that we had to confront these kind of laws.
It is bizarre to hear that today.
It is. It is. When you think about it, only 50 years. It doesn't seem like that long historically. And then Anne Frank, born this day in 1929, on her 13th birthday, June 12th, 1942, she got a diary where she chronicled her family's experience hiding from the Nazis in the Netherlands, one of the most widely circulated and widely read accounts of the Holocaust. So her diary lives on years after her birth and then her eventual death in a Nazi concentration camp. But the diary of Anne Frank, one of the most moving and, as I said, most well-known accounts of the Holocaust.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of anniversaries today.
And a lot of anniversaries,
good and bad,
but remembering history and trying to build and move on from history.
Excellent. Andrew Pachowski, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, among the top stories in the world, Russian police move in and detain opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Gulf nation's sanctions against Qatar are wreaking some havoc to its economy. An earthquake shaking western Turkey and the Greek island of Lesbos, and French President Macron winning big in a parliamentary vote. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. You're listening to International Edition. Myanmar State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi meeting today, Monday, with Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven in the Stockholm for bilateral talks. And after their meeting, Suu Kyi answering questions about Myanmar's handling of the situation in the state of Rakhine, where alleged human rights violations have been reported against the Rohingya Muslim minority in Buddhist-dominated Myanmar. It was a month ago that the UN had appointed a fact-finding mission to look into the alleged abuses of rape and torture against them, but Suu Kyi said there were reasons why Myanmar rejected the UN mission.
A fact-finding mission appointed by the United Nations would not have helped the situation. It would have created greater hostility between the different communities. So the reason why we dissociated ourselves from the resolution that appointed the fact-finding mission was because we did not feel it was in keeping with the needs of the region in which we are trying to establish harmony and understanding and to remove the fears that have kept the two communities apart for so long.
Aung San Suu Kyi is getting some criticism from some over the handling of the Rohingya issue because they think that she's backtracking on her fight for democracy and her fight against military repression, the things that actually won her a Nobel Peace Prize. But today she defended her actions and said she would agree to a special advisory commission.
Not that. It's because I do not speak up for one particular community. I think people forget that the Rakhine themselves are a minority. There are fewer Rakhine in the whole country than Muslims. So we have to keep the balance between being fair to both communities. So I don't think we see the Nobel Prize as something that's holding us back from the peace process.
Tens of thousands of Rohingya have been fleeing from Myanmar to Bangladesh over the years. Well, voters in the debt-plagued U.S. Caribbean territory of Puerto Rico on Sunday overwhelmingly choosing to become the 51st U.S. state, even though only 23% of the registered voters bothered to cast ballots. The island's governor, Ricardo Rosello, told pro-state supporters the U.S. will have to obey the will of our people. Now, while more than 500,000 people voted for statehood, only about 8,000 voted for independence and 6,800 for the status quo, heeding a call to boycott the non-binding referendum. Puerto Rico, which declared bankruptcy in May, has been a U.S. territory since 1898. Well, Peter Hakim is a senior scholar and president emeritus of the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the vote was essentially meaningless.
The supporters of independence and the supporters of continuing Commonwealth status with the U.S. really tried to boycott the vote, to encourage people not to show up. The fact that only 23% of the population came out and voted, and almost all of them were pro-statehood, is not surprising. And the fact is, it probably has almost no impact on what will happen to Puerto Rico in the coming period.
Was this a meaningless vote?
Pretty much a meaningless vote, I think. I think the idea was to try and show to a real extent that Puerto Rico's current status, which is sort of a really, you might call it, in the undefined zone that leaves open Puerto Rico's future, doesn't commit them to becoming independent, doesn't commit them to becoming a state. I suspect that this vote is largely has to do with internal Puerto Rican politics and not a whole lot with the ultimate status of the island.
Do they benefit from this status without becoming a state, or would it be good for them to become a state for them?
Puerto Rico is in the midst of a severe economic and in many respects social crisis with large-scale immigration toward the United States. And at this point, it's very clear that their economic problems are related to a variety of things. It's awful economic management by successive Puerto Rican governments. Has to do with, in many respects, very greedy hedge funds and other Wall Street institutions. And third, it has to do with a variety of perverse incentives that the United States over the years has provided Puerto Rico. My guess in the end that Puerto Rico would probably be better off if it did become a state.
The island's future status is up to the U.S. Congress, and Peter Hakim foresees no change by majority Republicans given its demographic tendency to vote Democratic.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
As Iraqi and coalition forces battle for the last remaining Islamic State strongholds in western Mosul, soldiers are saying that the toughest battles are still ahead. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from western Mosul.
The battle for western Mosul has destroyed nearly everything here, and almost no families remain. Islamic State militants held the area until 2 days ago by remaining hidden, traveling from house to house through holes they crashed in walls. Now Iraqi soldiers use the holes to avoid IS sniper fire. Families say they also used these holes to escape in recent days, with many ending up in scorching desert refugee camps. The Iraqi military says Mosul's old city is the last area left to conquer before IS is expelled from the city. Winning the old city, however, could be harder than anyone has imagined. In the coming days, the old city is expected to be completely surrounded by Iraqi forces. Then, soldiers say, the real fighting begins. IS's best fighters are the ones left behind, many with their families in the old city. Authorities hope that IS militants trapped inside Old Mosul will eventually run out of ammunition. But from the amount of fire we're hearing today, it seems the militants aren't holding anything back. Hundreds of thousands of people are still trapped inside IS territory, and families fleeing say many are without food or water. A rapid Iraqi and coalition attack could risk the lives of those families. But if the attack is too slow, the people could starve. Reporting from Mosul in Iraq, I'm Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Okay, Heather, thank you very much. Well, heading back here in the United States, the Trump administration stepped up enforcement against illegal immigrants. It's having an effect on many largely Hispanic communities across the U.S., including in one small rural town in southeastern Pennsylvania that's a source of labor for the surrounding farms and orchards. The town, York Springs, has evolved from a traditional white-only community over the past few decades to one where almost half the population of 800 people is Hispanic, mainly from Mexico. VOA's Bill Rogers has more from York Springs.
Mother's Day barbecue on the grounds of the York Springs Firehouse. It's a fundraiser by the all-volunteer force, and townspeople flock to buy a meal.
Free dinners.
Yep.
Missing are the town's numerous Hispanic residents. Deputy Fire Chief Robert Hawk wishes they would participate and maybe even volunteer. But he knows from experience, many fear any contact with authority.
A lot of times we'll go out in a car accident and we'll go up to the vehicle and nobody's there. And it's because they think they're in trouble and they run, you know.
In a county that's 95% white and voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump and is tough on immigration policies, York Springs is different. Once a 19th century crossroads and destination for its curative waters, it changed as the area's fruit orchards expanded and the need for labor grew.
We know this one too.
Kathy Snyder heads the York Springs Historical Society. She says Hispanic migrant workers at first only appeared at harvest time, but then some eventually stayed, not always legally.
We see a changeover happening in York Springs that more and more stay and make this their home. Husbands, the fathers might be working out in the orchards, but you're having wives finding jobs in some of the factories that are in the area.
Today, what was once a five-and-dime store is now Lua's Mexican store. Yet next to Lua's is where there was a recent immigration sweep, one of several raids this year that have frightened the community, says Pastor Ben Lease.
Their status is unsettled at best, and the really scary thing to me and to lots of folks here is kids go to school and come home and mom or dad or both may have been picked up.
The simply undocumented are not deliberately targeted for arrest, says Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but will be picked up if caught in raids going after convicted criminals. Trump supporter and local farmer David Reinecker supports arresting undocumented lawbreakers, but says
if they are law-abiding and are willing to become citizens and get the documentation even after they're here, I think they should be incorporated into our society.
At nearby Bermudian Springs School, kids and parents take part in a fundraising race. School officials and teachers are proud of the diversity. So is York Springs resident Sandra Morales, who says her three kids are doing well. But she fears for her husband, who is undocumented.
Mostly what they're looking for is the vans that take, that transport, you know, people from work to work.
And that's just the fear of me and my children have to live with.
It's a fear some children bring to school.
Even the young kindergartners are coming in and they're sad because they hear these things that are taking place, and it's heartbreaking that that's what a kindergartner is thinking about, you know.
Back in York Springs, a taco truck appears on some evenings, and people line up, both native-born and immigrant, to buy the savory food, a moment of mingling in relative safety in a town whose culture may be changing yet again. Bill Rogers, VOA News, York Springs, Pennsylvania.
And interestingly, it seems that illegal immigration across the southwest border has jumped up quite a bit in the month of May. Those numbers coming from Homeland Security, it went up 27%. That breaks a three-month streak of declines under President Trump, suggesting that the slump in migrants has bottomed out. The report coming out by the Washington Times, the Border Patrol nabbing over 14,000 illegal immigrants in the southwest last month. The number of illegal immigrants showing up at ports of entry without authorization also going up from about 4,600 to 5,400. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA News. You've been listening to us for 30 minutes. Come back a little bit later. We've got more for you. You can like us on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm Philip Alexio. Thanks for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
June marked the 70th anniversary of the European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan. It was one of the most successful U.S. foreign policy initiatives of the 20th century, praised by Winston Churchill as the most unselfish act by any great power in history. In the late 1940s, recovery from the devastation of the Second World War proved to be extraordinarily difficult for the economically devastated countries of Europe. 2 years after the war ended, Europe still had a long way to go just to catch up to pre-war agricultural and industrial output. Unemployment was high and food shortages persisted, further slowing down the recovery. In an effort to stabilize Europe and restore its industrial and agricultural production, the United States initiated the Marshall Plan, named after then-Secretary of State George Marshall. Between April 1948 and December 1951, the United States poured $13 billion in direct investment into 17 Western European countries, including former foes Germany and Italy. In today's money, that's around $130 billion. East European countries were also offered aid, but had to decline it on orders of the Soviet Union. The investment jump-started Western Europe's heavy industry base, provided jobs for millions of people, stabilized the economic and political systems, and raised the gross national product of the Marshall Plan countries by 15 to 25%. By 1951, it was clear that the initiative had met its objective of restoring the confidence of the European people in the economic future of their own countries and of Europe as a whole, and Western Europe was well on the way to a bright future. The Marshall Plan not only helped Europe recover and spurred rapid economic growth, it laid the foundation for the long-term peace and prosperity that both the United States and Europe have enjoyed for nearly three-quarters of a century, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Perhaps more importantly, the Marshall Plan laid the foundation for the transatlantic bond and partnership that has helped Europe remain whole, free, at peace, and prosperous. Today, as we face new threats to our security, unity, and prosperity, the Marshall Plan reminds us of what is possible when the United States and Europe work together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.